California True Crime is a podcast that sometimes deals with heinous acts of violence towards other individuals. This podcast may not be suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome back to this episode of California True Crime. This is Sean. I'll be here for the second part of the Puente Hills Mall murders. With me is Jessica and Charles. How are you guys tonight?
Really good.
Same.
Good. So we left off. Let me give a little recap because this was a large story that we went over so far. What we have is a lot of robberies, kidnappings, and five murders that we went over where we last left off was the police just raided an apartment complex in West Covina and arrested suspects and also arrested a woman at a Jack in the Box. And they arrested four people. And this was for the two mall murders and the murders and the murder of Willie Sams. So let's go into a little bit about the suspects now. First, there was John Irvin Lewis II. He was 21 years old and was recently released from California Youth Authority Facility. He'd been in there because of a weapons charge. With John was his half-sister, Robin Machuca, age 26 years old. And I'm not saying anything or acting like I'm part on the defense, but I would like to give you a little background on both of them growing up. They both grew up together in an area called Baldwin Park, and at a very young age, John's father was killed from a shooting. Robin's father was in prison for an armed robbery when she was born. Their mother remarried, and the stepfather was very abusive mentally, physically, and sexually to both John and Robin. John was removed from the home at an early age, and when he wasn't in juvenile detention, he would live with one of his other older siblings. When Robin was 12, her stepfather got her pregnant. From an article in the Los Angeles Times, it said that Robin was interviewed in jail waiting for her arraignment. She says that after a few months after having the baby, the stepfather handed her mom a gun and told her what he had done and to shoot all the kids. The mother said she wouldn't, but she wouldn't kick out the stepfather either. Robin then jumped out of the window with her baby and never came back. She left the baby in foster care and ended up joining a major Los Angeles gang. Their mother died in 1983 of a drug overdose. At the age of 15, Robin was arrested for burglary and was sent to a juvenile detention center. While there, Robin learned secretarial skills, and when she got out, she got a job at a mortgage company in West Covina. Everything was going swell until her apartment was burglarized, and it really bothered her. She quit work and started smoking PCP, and in the article, it also talks about how she would regularly visit the baby she put into foster care and said, "We grew up together."
Did the article talk about the burglarization of her apartment? Was that really what sent her down?
Yeah, because this was still the jail interview, and this is what she said really bothered her. So, Jessica, I wanted to bring up something because we had a discussion during the Carrie Stainer episodes where the one reporter went in and interviewed Carrie, and I thought it was kind of reckless on his part of the reporter and the jail, and you said Carrie had the right to talk. In this case, after the Times interviewed Robin in jail, the judge in the case put it in a gag order that prevented police attorneys, prosecutors, court employees, and defendants from talking about the case. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's kind of really different. In this case, you have a judge who's looking at the whole trial and trying to decide to protect everyone's rights. You know, both your right to a fair trial and your right to be able to, you know, First Amendment right. And he's making a decision based on that. And it doesn't just apply to the defendants. It applies to everybody.
Right.
I think that's a little different than in the Carrie case. It was kind of unclear what the rules were, and it seemed sort of like who's making the decision and if it's a person who's in charge of a jail or someone watching the jail.
Yeah.
That person doesn't really have the same weight as a judge. And then after the trial, I assume that doesn't last. They still have the ability
right,
to speak. So it's just kind of a different situation to me.
Another suspect who was arrested, Vincent Hubbard, also age 26, was Robin's boyfriend and was also part of a gang. While they dated, Vincent was arrested on some drug-related charges and was sent into prison. He served roughly 2 years, and when he got out, Robin and Vincent rekindled their relationship right away. Now, these three were the ones that were arrested when they raided the apartment. The six-year-old daughter that was in there was Robin's. It wasn't the same kid that she gave up. It was a different kid, but it was Robin's. I don't know who the father was.
And the gang that Vincent belongs to, is it the same gang that Robin's family's been involved with, or?
Yes.
Okay.
So the girl arrested at the Jack in the Box was Eileen Huber, age 20. There was a show that seemed to focus on her on the TV One network called For My Man, Fatal Attraction. And throughout the show, they kept saying good girl gone bad, which I'm not really sure if I agree with that. She had no criminal record, but to say that it seems to be insinuating that the others were bad kids stay bad, which I just don't like. Also, when I hear the saying, I guess I interpret good girl as good life. When they kept repeating it, I just kept thinking they're saying she had a good life and everything like that. Eileen also grew up in Baldwin Park, and at some point her parents separated and she lived with her dad. Her dad worked a lot, so it seems she seemed to be on her own. As she got older, she started hanging out with girls that were in gangs. It was also awesome in this TV One network show that they have this reenactment of Eileen hanging out with two girls on like some steps in front of an apartment. They were kind of grouped together and they take a selfie with her phone's front facing camera. Now, maybe this would go with the good girl gone bad, because if this is even the same year that the murder happened in 91, she would have had to at least get the first camera cell phone, the Nokia 7650 or the Sanyo SPC 5300, 11 years before it was publicly available in 2002. The show was just, it bothered me.
So shoddy reenactments.
Yeah, of like taking something that happened in 91, calling her a good girl gone bad the whole time, and then selfie of a front-facing camera. I don't think anyone had that in 91, so.
That's another instance of some of those, you know, made-for-TV sort of documentary kind of things that don't really do a good... I mean, they're more interested in spinning a story than actually reporting
right.
The facts or to get the, you know, different sides of the same story.
Eileen also started doing bad in school and ended up dropping out of high school. After this, she was having some drug issues, so her dad bought her a car and encouraged her to get her GED. Eileen had an older brother who, at the age of 14, was caught with drugs, and dad kicked him out of the house. Dad said that he did not kick out Eileen since she was a girl.
So again, that good girl gone bad thing is just a moniker that somebody else is putting, because it seems like she's been having trouble for a while.
Yeah,
it's like a lot of other kids that grew up in the same neighborhood, it just, for whatever reason, they latch on to her.
Right. And I think a lot of it, they kept repeating, no criminal record kind of thing, which, you know.
Doesn't really mean anything.
Right, exactly. So it looks like John and Eileen started dating roughly a year before they were arrested. John and Eileen actually knew each other in high school, but they never dated. It was more of like, I know who that person is. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until early or mid-August of 1991, the same month most of the crimes happened, that John would move in with Robin and Vincent at apartment E of the Woodside Village Apartments in West Covina, because John was having issues with his friend and brother-in-law, Derek Colbert, who he lived with at the time, and we'll come back to Derek soon. So from what I gathered was that John was part of the Bloods and Vincent and Robin were part of the Crips. But since they were living under the same roof, Robin told them they needed to like squash their rivalry and get along, which I guess they did. They were friends. Around mid-August, Robin also received an eviction notice because the neighbors complained about constant noise and partying. I tried to actually contact the Woodside Village Apartments just to get a layout of apartment E. When looking up the place, they didn't really have what E. They had plans that were lettered, but everything else had numbers. I found some floor plans that said E, but they were all different. So just from the reports, I think I know it, at least it's a one-bedroom apartment. So because you had the four, I don't know, Eileen was there. She didn't really claim it her residence, but the four of them were always there with that child too. So recap, John and Robin are half brother and sister. Robin and Vincent are dating. John and Eileen are dating. And there's a six-year-old.
Which is Robin's kid.
Robin's kid. Don't know who the father is.
And John is a member of which gang?
The Bloods, and Robin and Vincent are part of the Crips. A search of the apartment found a plethora of evidence. On the living room floor, they found a Ruger handgun. A loaded Smith & Wesson revolver was under the child's bed in the bedroom. There was five rifles, a rifle case, ammunition clips, and two gun belts throughout the apartment, ammunition boxes and a bayonet, a firearm cleaning rod, and loose ammunition were found in the dishwasher. Plastic ties, just like the ones used to bind Shirley's hands, were found. There was also a roll of duct tape. An unexploded triple-aught shotgun shell was found in some ivy outside the front door. And in Eileen's car, they found a survival style knife. Though they did not find the though they found the shotgun shell, they never found the shotgun.
That unexploded shell that they found in the ivy outside the front door, was it like a misfire? Or was it like...
Yes.
Okay.
That's what they're saying. I think that's why they're connecting it with the Eugene Valdez robbery where they tried to kill him.
Right, right. So that's the example. They got home, they pull the shell out, they toss it out.
Yeah, because it misfired. Right. But they never found the shotgun. Besides the small arsenal, they also found some of the victim's property, like Shirley's white purse, her credit cards, camera, and a diamond engagement and wedding ring set. They also found Willie Sam's radio from his car, and Robin was wearing some of Elizabeth Nesbitt's jewelry. Also, when they arrested Eileen at the Jack in the Box, she was wearing a diamond ring that belonged to Elizabeth Nesbitt. She told the police that John had given it to her as an engagement ring. Also, we should go back to all those car parts that were taking off Eugene Valdez's 1983 Oldsmobile Cutlass. If you remember, random parts were taken, like the hood, the front fender, speaker covers, and the left rear taillight. I guess John owned a very similar car, and all those parts were on his car now.
So they basically find everything.
Yeah, and they're like scavengers of their robberies. They used, or is scavengers the right word, or salvagers?
Yeah. Wow.
And no real attempt to hide any of it either. I mean, the weapons strewn out all over the house is one thing, but then you're driving around a car with stolen parts on it.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they had, like, we do this till we get caught, or they had the mentality, we'll never get caught.
Right.
A couple days later, there were multiple raids at the apartment complex and other places also. There seemed to be a lot of information here in this one article from the Los Angeles Times on September 3rd, 1991. Now, they knew about Derek Colbert from the confessions, and they went to arrest him. I'm just going to read these two paragraphs straight from the paper because it's weird to me. Quote, in Baldwin Park, officer said Derek Colbert has been arrested without incident, but witnesses say police had fired at least one shotgun blast during the raid and had gone to make sure no pellets passed through the wall. At Colbert's apartment later, there were the cries of a baby, but no one responded to knocks on the door. Neighbors described him as an alternately polite and hot-tempered man who seemed to run with the wrong crowd. So they talk about arresting him, but then they talk about this baby crying, and they knock on the door, and no one answers. They never go back to the baby. I thought it was, maybe it was the news reporters that went in, and they didn't want to answer. I was just concerned about the baby when I read this whole article.
It's confusing. Was the baby at Colbert's apartment, or was it just...
That's how it was
written.
Maybe
next door, or it's just, it's kind of confusing the way they even wrote it.
Right.
I'm not sure where the...
Yeah, it was odd. So these raids, which seemed to be five in all, three were in Baldwin Park and two more in West Covina, actually took another life. Daryl Stevens, 27, also lived at the Woodside Village Apartments. It says that Stevens was not a suspect, but they had monitored a conversation that he had with an informant on the case. The police were looking for the shotgun that was never found, and they believe Stevens' roommate might have had it. The informant said that Stevens said that no one would come into his apartment without a warrant, and if they did, he would shoot them. So they sent in a 14-member SWAT team to his second-story apartment around 2 a.m. They rammed his door, and the police say that they identified themselves, getting no answer. The police saw him kneeling on the floor, reaching under the mattress when they entered the bedroom door. They yelled freeze, scared that he was arming himself. When he removed his arm quickly, two officers fired multiple shots, hitting Stevens in the torso. They found no weapon under the bed. This was from an article at the time, just so you know, because when we go forward, witnesses who lived in the apartment said it went down a different way. All they heard was the ramming of the door and then shots. They said the police didn't say anything. The two officers were investigated, but it was never sent to trial. In an 18-page report that came out in 1993, this says that they entered. Stevens yelled something in anger that they rammed his door and came in. He was lying on his bed face down when the police entered, and his right arm was under his body and his left arm dangling over the side of the bed. The police shouted, "Let me see your hands," and when he moved, he was shot 28 times in the back. I'm not trying to take sides or try to insinuate who's telling the truth. This is just with the paper, and it's just sad that Stevens lost his life as a ripple effect of these murders.
Right.
Do they find, I know he didn't have a gun under his bed or anything like that, but do they find the shotgun?
They don't. No, the shotgun is still missing to today.
Did they find any weapons in Stevens' house?
They didn't say. They just said they didn't find it under the bed or the shotgun that they were looking for.
I'm trying to imagine what it would be like to have someone coming into your house that way. Even police, when you're dead asleep. I mean, I'm a really light sleeper, so I might be different, but I know you're a pretty heavy sleeper, Charles. I can't imagine you responding to people at all. It would take you a while to come around.
No, yeah, right. But then in a small apartment. I'm assuming it's a relatively small apartment, and then having your door kicked in.
Well, it's not in a safe area necessarily either, you said, right, Sean? Right. So, I mean, it could be anybody.
And knowing what the police know, that this is a potentially, especially after they've already searched the one house and basically pulled out an arsenal. Again, like you said, not taking sides. We only have what was reported, and this is not a case we necessarily looked into, but the idea is a police officer walking through that front door where you know the person's already made threats and what's potentially lying on the other side of the door. But again, then 28 times in the back.
Right. And how, if you're going with what witnesses say, this was fast. It wasn't like, you know,
a protracted standoff between 14 officers and somebody in an apartment.
Yeah. And out of the 20, the thing to me that is pretty insane with the 28 shots is that it actually only came from two officers. So only two officers were charged with the shooting because two officers shot. So two officers shot 28 times.
Wow.
Oh, so none of the other 14 officers.
The 12 other ones weren't. Yeah. It was just these two officers that were charged.
And like you said, this is another death laid at the feet of the currently in the story, suspects in this.
Right. So John Lewis made a confession after he was arrested. He confessed to the killing of Willie Sams, Elizabeth Nesbitt, Shirley Denogen, and also Jose Avina. Now, what I gathered is that the police haven't really linked the first murders of Jose Avina, but he confessed to it. At least the papers at the time weren't linking the three. They were only linking the three last murders to the suspects. One thing that is interesting is that Lewis denied the kidnapping of Eugene Valdez, the one that jumped off the cliff and survived, even though he had all his car parts.
That's weird. I wonder why he would confess to everything else, but that one.
Yeah, when I thought of it, I don't know if it was like a pride thing that they didn't actually kill that man.
Right.
Lewis's statement for Jose Avina's murder said that he and two friends were heading to a party in a friend's car while the friend was driving. The friend accidentally bumped Avina's truck when the truck stopped suddenly. He said that the two argued with Jose, and Jose said some racial slurs to them. John then got out of the car with a shotgun, and John said he saw Jose reach for a gun, and that is when John shot him in the face. The defendant also said about why he used triple-aught buck ammunition for the shotgun. He said that growing up, his stepfather had told him, quote, "If you ever buy a shotgun and you want some shit that will blow a motherfucker's head off, this is what you buy." So I also want to bring up what the case law says under the section that says, quote, "factual background," because this story is told different ways. On the same Jose Avena murder, John and Eileen were in Eileen's car while they were following John's friend Derek Colbert and Timmy Lane in Lane's car. So they're behind them in another car. So it's Timmy Lane's car that bumps Jose Avena's truck. And then John gets out of Eileen's car, goes up when the truck pulls over and said, "Give him the keys." He shot him and pulled him out. So this is the factual background that was decided in 2008. Now, if you watch the TV One show that had the great cell phone part, it does say that Eileen was driving her car and John was in it. What they leave out is Derek and Timmy in the lead car altogether. They just said Eileen bumped the truck. I don't know if I missed something, but I'm going to stick with the factual background, like instead of that show, because they never mentioned them at all, the other car. I couldn't find anything more on Lane or Colbert after this. The last thing I read was that they were holding Colbert after this arrest because of parole violation, but that was it.
And then, and there's no other motive really for this crime. I mean, they're just out looking to steal stuff, and Jose Avena had the terrible luck to be the person that runs across them, or they run across him, really.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if murder was the intention. I'm pretty sure robbery was, and he had a very nice truck, so that's all I know.
Does anything ever say who the informant to the police is?
Oh, for the other thing, like back?
Yeah, when you were, they said they had an informant. I mean, it could be one of these people.
Yeah, it could be. They never said. It was the informant was only on the, in the paper. It didn't talk about the informant on the report afterwards. Now, regarding the murder of Willie Sams, John told the basic stuff that was in episode one, but also said he killed him because he could identify him, and also shot him multiple times because he resembled his stepfather. He also made a statement that he knew what he was doing was wrong and said, quote, "I'm not afraid to die. I have nothing to live for." Another thing he told police during the interviews that he did these murders to get back at society. And this was that get back at society was used in so many papers. That's like, you know, the thing that they used. At the same time John was confessing, Eileen was also confessing to the crimes the same as Lewis was, but Robin and Vincent did not make any statements at all. During arraignment, Vincent stuck his tongue out at reporters, which in the paper, there's a really good picture of it. They played it on the news, and that's when they interview, you know, the interviews I love with, like, normal people. Oh, this is ridiculous. You know, their comments and stuff like that. Before we get into pretrial and the charges, I want to backtrack just a little. If you notice, for the first couple murders, there seemed to just be a shotgun involved. And in the latter, there was different weapons used, like the ones they found in the apartment. In between kidnapping and attempted murder of Eugene Valdez and the robbery of Juan Rios and Sonia Aguirre, there was the robbery of Gary Huber, which is Eileen's father. Gary, Eileen, and the older brother all went to Pismo Beach for like an overnight getaway on August 13th, 1991. When they got back the next day, all of Gary's firearms were stolen out of his house. So all these weapons that were stolen were the weapons that they found in Robin's apartment in West Covina. Gary, who was an active gun collector and a member of the NRA, had a substantial collection. There's one paragraph in the same article that was pretty interesting, and I don't know if this goes with the lifestyle of good girl gone bad. It says, quote, "Once," Huber said, "when he got word that gangbangers were headed into the neighborhood, he grabbed a gun, went outside, flopped down on his belly, ready for a confrontation that never came. Kids in the neighborhood took to calling him John Wayne. Indeed, John Wayne posters papered his living room walls," end quote. I mean, this doesn't seem like normal behavior, right? I mean, I can understand extremely dangerous neighborhoods and you have to do that, but
posting up in your front yard with your gun ready to shoot invaders.
On your stomach. Right. You know, this
is the John Wayne thing is normal.
That
I mean,
okay, that's fine.
I'm a fan of John Wayne. I can see having a poster.
That's perfectly fine. Yeah. I mean,
and even owning, I mean, I can even see having a gun collection.
That's fine. Yeah. I mean, people have gun collections.
I do. And it's hard because if you live in those neighborhoods and you're exposed to a lot of that violence anyway around the neighborhood, I don't necessarily know. I mean, we've all had our own experiences living in maybe not the greatest neighborhoods. And everybody has their own way of reacting to that. But again, grabbing a rifle and sitting in your front yard on your stomach, waiting for these invading hordes of gangbangers to come to that's not right.
Also in the article, it says he was asked by a reporter how he felt about his Ruger being linked to the mall murders. He said, quote, "Darlin', see, I belong to the NRA. I'm a very strong believer in it's not the guns that kill people, it's the people." He also goes on to say, "I told the sheriff, if she pulled the trigger, I would be glad to pull the damn plug that puts her away." He also would not visit her in jail after she was arrested because he was too disappointed. And that quote that he said about pulling the plug, this reminded me of the quote by Kay Stainer when the state was figuring out if they were going to put Kerry for the death penalty. She said, quote, "If his dying would bring these people back that he killed, I say do it. But executing Kerry is not going to bring them back." It's similar. I mean, it's interesting. It's just Kay's was in court that, you know, but his was in a paper. I think it's just strong words for your own kids.
I think they also come, they might come from two different places too.
Right.
Because I think Kay's is, I won't say it's more compassionate. It's not. It feels different. It feels like it comes from a different place.
Right.
That she's struggling with all of this terrible tragedy. And Gary seems a bit more callous, mm-hmm. you know, in defense. And, you know, maybe he's feeling
right.
put upon for.
At the same time, we can't really place it on what he's saying, because right. there's probably a billion emotions and he might be putting up a front in front of reporters anyway, but
just as an outsider looking at those two, it does to me feel one in Gary's is a lot more callous and unaffected than mm-hmm. Kay's.
Hi everyone. This is Ariel Cooksey from the podcast Malice. Sometimes we think about predators as monsters, as otherworldly, as if no human being could perpetrate the acts that they commit. But when we really think about it, only human beings execute these heinous acts. And if you're like me, you want to know why. So if you want to take this journey with me and to explore the ins and outs, the psychology, the sociology, the neurology, the environment, the family, all of the dysfunction and pathology that leads to violent offenders, please join us at Malice. You can find it on all major podcasting sites. Thanks so much. Bye.
In another article, 5 days after the arrest, the Los Angeles Times went back to the mall, and they actually found Wynonna Gordon there again and interviewed her. This is the lady that said she was optimistic that this kind of stuff wouldn't happen, that would happen to someone else. This time in the article, it says, quote, "The man who was following her through the shopping mall parking lot was sort of scruffy looking," Wynonna Gordon recalls, "but the 55-year-old woman used her head. I made a quick turn towards two people I'd never seen before and started talking to them," she said. The man walked on. As the article goes on, it's interesting how they have crime prevention officers listing off a bunch of things you can do if something doesn't feel right. It was almost like Stranger Danger, but for adults, like things, use the ATM only during daylight, watch your surroundings before you do anything. But the best one was from the crime prevention officer, was about when you're physically assaulted. She suggested a variety of things you could do or say. Quote, recite something from the Bible, say a prayer, or say you've got AIDS. A lot of times that turns them off. I know it's 91, so, you know, right. But it was just...
I should just say, as a girl, this is the kind of stuff you're taught. I don't know what it's like to be a boy, but this is the kind of stuff you're taught pretty early on.
Yeah,
you're constantly asked to be aware to how to get, you know, just walk through a parking lot with your keys out, stuff you should say. I've never had the one about AIDS. And like you're saying, this is a time of misinformation. So that probably plays into this. But telling a rapist you have an STD or trying to humanize yourself, that's kind of stuff that's I think we're taught.
Right. And I wasn't. I understand exactly what you're saying.
No, I don't think I was. I mean, other than the overprotectiveness of like my folks, like, you know, my mom would tell me, hey, keep an eye out, and but not to that level. It was.
And like any 90s afternoon television, like Oprah or Phil Donahue will have episodes where, and it always changed. Every year was something different.
Right.
It was very confusing what you're supposed to do to keep yourself safe.
Yeah.
But your point about it being like stranger danger is, I think, a really valid one, because when we talked about going back to the Stephen Stanner and kind of the our childhood of the birth of stranger danger, and as we got older, seeing that evolve to meet, you know, because that's a constant thing. As more and more people are aware and the information age gets going on and we're more connected to a 24-hour news cycle and we're seeing more bad things in the news, it's freaking people out to the point where they're constantly looking over their shoulder, I think. Mm-hmm. And some of awareness is good, but some of it can be too much, I think.
Right.
It really reminds me a little bit of the last episode we talked about, the peer victim
right.
type of stuff, that there's this idea that you can protect yourself and that other people are putting themselves in harm's way. Because I think in this case, the idea that someone could just walk up to you in a mall, just pick you out, and murder you.
Yeah, anyone was the pure victim, it seems like.
Right, it's terrifying. And I think the whole thing is kind of victim blaming in a way, this idea that you can protect yourself.
But you see, you're right, you see those kind of things around those stories where it is random. Because it's, I think people can see that, well, I go to that mall, or I've done that, or I've gone to the ATM after dark, and you start seeing yourself in the victim, where some of the other stories that we've talked about or that we will talk about, sometimes it's harder for people to see themselves in that victim, and it doesn't make them any less innocent or any less a victim. I think people need to maybe take themselves out and empathize a little bit more sometimes.
The officer goes on to say later, quote, we're in difficult times, the economy, people have lost their jobs, they're addicted to drugs. People who are desperate will do anything, end quote. And I found this interesting because you read or hear people say or read things like the 90s, the last great decade, or, you know, all this stuff and how things have changed so much since the 90s. But this sounds exactly like what goes on now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's an interesting quote because it plays into a lot of the stuff that was big when we grew up, like the war on drugs
mm-hmm.
and gang violence you were always it's hearing
crack
about.
Crack epidemic. Yeah. Which, was, I mean, you know, we know there was gangs. We know there were sure. drugs. But I think since we've been doing this podcast and the stories we've been researching and even going in and looking at other news, this stuff was going on all the time.
Yeah.
The well, drugs I mean, changed. The gangs changed. But people are still doing terrible things to one another. It's just people are either paying attention to it more, or it's coming in a different form of media. People are consuming the information differently.
And it was never as simple as those.
No, not at all. It's not you're walking down the street and a bad person does.
Yeah.
A lot of the cases, you know, that you read about, it's not just a stranger doing it. It's somebody you know, or, you know, I think this is what makes a case like this so frightening. It's because it is really random.
Yeah. So the first two murders weren't really linked to the mall murders until sometime after, maybe a month or so, in the papers. Like the cops knew right away when the confessions happened. So since the first were dubbed the San Gabriel Valley killings and the later were the mall murders, they kind of started adding them together or just saying something else. That's where the two names come in. So now getting into the pretrial, right away, the defense tries to throw out the confession of John Lewis saying that he was still questioned after he had asked for an attorney. It says in the case law that he waived his Miranda rights at 9 a.m. on Friday when he was arrested, and then he made his first statement. At 10:15 a.m., he made another statement. Then at 12:36 p.m., Lewis asked for an attorney and the questions stop. So then Sunday at 4 p.m., Lewis still has not talked to an attorney, and he contacted the police and made a third statement then at 9:58 p.m. on Sunday. He'll make his final statement sometime after. So with the objection by the defense, the judge said that the police didn't have to give him an attorney right away, since that usually is not provided until arraignment, which was scheduled on Tuesday because this was a holiday weekend. The judge said that Lewis, quote, didn't wait long enough. I didn't know that that was how it worked. I thought you asked for a lawyer and you wait a couple hours maybe, but I didn't know that they could just not do it until right before trial.
Well, if you have a lawyer that you're going to pay, okay, someone has contacted a lawyer for you, or if you've maybe a phone call or something to do that, then they might come within a couple hours.
But a public
defender. Assuming he has a public defender.
Right.
So yeah, that would be assigned to you once you say you can't afford an attorney in arraignment. And then it would be up to you to keep quiet. I mean, contacting the police and making statements is
right.
a choice.
But I'm just wondering if they didn't tell him that also. I mean, I guess they don't have to, but
they just probably would have read him his rights.
Well, it's that's part of the Miranda rights. You have a right to remain silent. You have a right to an attorney. If you can't provide one, one would be provided for you.
But it doesn't say until arraignment.
Well, right. But he says he did waive his Miranda rights. And in your Miranda rights, they tell you that anything you say can be used against you.
But then when he does ask for an attorney, what I'm saying is that they probably didn't say, you're not going to get one until Tuesday. And that's why he sat there for a couple of days.
That would be interesting to find that out, is to see if when a police, if I am charged with a crime and I say I waive my Miranda rights and I'll make a confession, but I want to talk to a lawyer, then yeah, what is that time frame? And is that different depending on the crime or the, and would it be dependent on the availability of a public? Because I don't think it's any secret to people that are listening that, you know, our public defenders are overworked and underpaid. But so if you live in an area like this, you know, in Southern California, where there is probably a lot of these cases that public defenders will have to use, is that longer than if you live somewhere else?
Well, and I think it's a judge who has to assign someone to you, you have to say before the judge you can't afford an attorney. That's what I've seen in the ones I've researched.
So then
the judge says, okay. Right. Otherwise, there's no reason for them to know you can or can't.
Right.
Oh, okay. There are more things that the defense does to get the confession thrown out, like saying they didn't have a warrant, violation of both Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights, and change of venue. It was never thrown out. They were also being tried all together, all the defendants were, and the defense teams were trying to separate all of them into their own trials. The court just made statements and other things redacted, so it could be all in one trial. I guess there were some things that were missed during the redaction. The judge had to say, jury disregard what you just heard, like during the trial, which they've already seen it. But another thing with the redactions that was weird, how they edited them. For example, in John's edited statement about the Nisbet homicide, the unedited version, he says, quote, "Then me and Vincent got out of the car, told Robin to follow us. Vincent walked over first, took the gun out, got in behind her, the lady, and told her, don't scream and don't move." So then they redacted the statements to read it to the jury so they could all have it together, and it sounded like this. "Then got out of the car, walked over first, took the gun out, got in behind her, the lady, and told her, don't scream and don't move." So with the context of the redaction, it sounds like John is saying that he did it all, even though in the mm-hmm. old one he said Vincent and Robin, but taking out their names, and then the jury hears the redacted statement, and it just sounds like John's confessing right there. So right. That was one of the
things. Do they also get a copy of the statement, or they just hear it?
I don't know.
Because then they would know if it's a copy. Redacted. Yeah, they would see too, in theory.
Unless he might have talked in third person during that trial. then
yeah, maybe
he starts saying John. I'm just, you know, you never know. But it was just interesting how the redactions made it seem like him.
Yeah.
You can see then why it would be such a big deal for the defense to get it separated so that nothing that could be misconstrued, nothing can be, you know, like you are only focused on this one person.
Right.
That you're not, your fate's not connected to, because now that it's one trial, whatever happens to one could potentially happen to everybody.
Correct. There was also an issue during jury selection based on race issues. Some of the defense would make motions for a mistrial because the prosecutors dismissed five potential black jurors and some young jurors. The jury at the end was built with two black jurors, one Hispanic, and the rest were unspecified. I think it's time to bring this up here, since we haven't, that Eileen was the only white person from the four suspects. Vincent and John were black, and Robin's father was a Native American. With all the info that we know, like, once two white women were killed at the mall, and how the sergeant called them pure victims, Eileen being white and completely classified as the good girl wrapped up in the bad crowd, do you think race plays into this at all?
When you're talking about race, Sean, what are you really...
I'm meaning, it's not like the murders. I'm talking about how the media played it out, how the cops played it out, such as once the two women were, the white women were taken from the mall, and then the cop goes on to call them pure victims. With Eileen being white, and she gets this attention of the good girl, and she's wrapped up in the bad thing, and then the potential jurors being, you know, knocked out. I'm wondering if, not the murders, but with everything else in this case.
Like the way the media is portraying it.
Media
the and narrative how the, that's being
and how the written. Cops are going with it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's 91, so I'm just wondering if...
Yeah, it seems like from what you've told us and what we've read, that there is a narrative being spun, and it does play into some of those racial stereotypes that I think... that aren't just prevalent in 91, but that we're still battling with today. You know, like you said, the pure victims, but Jose was just a guy driving a pickup truck down the road, and he was brutally murdered for nothing. But I wonder if he was spoken about in the same terms as the two people that were taken from the mall. You know, the same thing with Willie,
right.
You know? And Eileen, looking at, she's just as guilty as anybody else, but the way they frame her and her backstory and stuff, it does seem different.
Right.
I think, especially when I hear the term good girl, when you're talking about that episode of TV, I always kind of think of, that's just kind of a way of sexualizing women into mm-hmm. like good girls and bad girls. And then when it sounds like they only really covered her in that. And then when you bring up that she's white, I think that brings a whole nother layer to that. To that stereotype,
because they don't talk about it doesn't seem like they talk about Robin in the same.
There wasn't much on, like, in the shows or even in the papers. There's not much, and if they do talk about Robin, they put her in a different style than they talk about Eileen.
So it definitely sounds like then, at least for the way that they're talking about it, race played a role.
And it still, again, it still goes on. I mean, how many times I know the three of us. I've had this conversation a lot, not just within the podcast, but also outside. When you see some of these stories about crimes and the way they're portrayed, not just, and it's easy. I think it's easy always just to blame the media, but it's the people who consume the media just as much. They get wrapped up in those stories really from one narrative and not necessarily always an equal or fair one.
There was so much the defense tried to get thrown out of court, a ton of evidence, which most of it was able to come in. All of that spoke about, like, the weapons, the victim's properties, all this plus more was used in the trial. The defendants were charged with 100 felonies total from 8 different incidents. These charges included conspiracy, kidnapping, robbery, murder, and receiving stolen property. The trial starts on November 2nd, 1992. One thing I noticed, instead of calling them a cult, or serial killers, even. John Ergo, the deputy district attorney, used the term crime family, and it seems to go with the whole conspiracy to commit approach, that even if they didn't actually take the life, they played a role. So I think it was just the how he's trying to get them all convicted with, like, their not separate trials. So using the term crime family was trying to beat it in there. After the trial that lasted about 6 weeks, all four defendants were convicted of murder and many other felony counts that totaled 78 between the four of them. So out of the 100, they got 78. It took the jurors 4 days to deliberate. During the trial, over 100 witnesses were called and over 260 pieces of evidence were presented. After the jury read all the felony charges, John Lewis was convicted of all five murders, and he blurted out, "All in a day's work." Vincent Hubbard, who was convicted of only two of the four murders he was charged with, was talking and joking with Robin during the jury reading the verdicts. When his attorney tried to quiet him down, he said out loud, quote, "It doesn't matter, I don't give a fuck." Robin was convicted of all three she was charged with and was just shaking her head no while everything was read. Eileen was charged with three out of the four murders and was upset, crying, and breathing heavily. So in the article, just going back to what we were just talking about, the descriptive words that they used with Eileen during this was upset, crying, and breathing heavily, which it's more descriptive words than anyone else that got. I'm making a point of how she might have been portrayed.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to imagine sitting in this in the courtroom because you're someone you know or someone you love, a family member has been murdered, and they're just joking.
Right.
And, oh my gosh, how terrible.
Loretta Sams, the widow of Willie, was in court during this and did not seem to have closure from this. She said, quote, "They had no remorse for what they did. They didn't care about human life whatsoever. This just brings it all back like it was yesterday." Maria Vega, the fiance of Jose Avina, was also in court that day. She said, quote, "The death penalty is the least they could get for all the pain and hurt they caused." On March 3rd, 1993, John Lewis was sentenced to death while the others were sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The judge said of Lewis that he must die in the gas chamber of San Quentin. I could not find more really about his life in prison since the conviction. Thought it was interesting that it brought up the gas chamber too. I just don't hear that much anymore. Mm-mm. It's more a lethal injection. Vincent Hubbard is incarcerated at Mule Creek State Prison in Ione, California. Couldn't find any updates on him either. Eileen and Robin are both at Central California Women's Facility in Chowchilla. Though I couldn't find too much info on Robin, except she did write a letter to someone who wrote her. Eileen, from what I have read, is a quiet, keeps to herself inmate, saves all her money she makes and receives. It goes towards classes for an associate's degree, and she's also writing her memoirs she plans to give away to girls' homes and juvenile facilities. So that's about it on this case. What'd you guys think? I'm still shocked that I had not heard about this one before, because it just seems like a really big one. It's Southern California. Mm-hmm. It happened at malls.
Several people.
Yeah. I don't know. I know it was 91. Maybe I just wasn't paying attention. And it did seem to be covered a lot. No, the trial was hardly covered in the paper. I couldn't find that. But still, it's one of the, like I brought up in the very first part of the first episode, some have resonance through our lives. And ones that are insane like this are kind of just thrown away, which is just weird to me.
It is. And and like you said, it is not, in one respect, it really is a straightforward, I mean, case. With John's confession, that's what floored me. The mountain of evidence. It's not like they did have, I mean, it's laying all over the floor. It's in the guy's car. It's everywhere. It's, that was a crazy part to me. And for a relatively short amount of time, how much damage these people did.
Right.
You know, how many lives they took, but also the ripple effects that go out from that for that community.
Like with Daryl Stevens too.
Right. I mean, again, it's another, like you said earlier, another life chalked up to that. But, and then the pain and suffering ancillarily to, you know, Robin's children, the child, the six-year-old she had, who's now lost her mother because of a poor choice that the mom made. Yeah, it's a really terrible case.
Tonight's cold case also comes from Jeanette Marantos at the LA Times and has a strikingly similar story to our last cold case. Mikey Santero Tarango, a 41-year-old Latino man, was fatally shot December 23, 2019, in the 1100 block of East Larkwood Street in West Covina. Tarango was in his garage with his brother and a female friend around 9 p.m. when two men walked up and at least one of them began shooting, striking all three of the people inside the garage. Tarango was pronounced dead at the scene at 9:25 p.m. Both other victims survived. Tarango's mother, Diane, described her son as, quote, a beloved father, son, grandpa, uncle, and beloved friend. Investigators do not have a motive for the shooting. Anyone with information is asked to call the West Covina Police Department at 626-939-8688. Those wishing to remain anonymous should call Crime Stoppers at 800-222-8477.
Thank you for listening to this episode of California True Crime. If you have any questions or just want to talk with us, you can catch us on our Facebook page or join our Facebook group where we post up questions and have discussions with the listeners. You can follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Cali True Crime. We appreciate a review on whatever listening platform you're listening to us on. Special thanks to our quality control manager, Melanie Duncan. This has been recorded at Chateau Walnut.